Today's Teisho will be on case 32 in the Pien Lu, the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 32 is entitled Jo-Joza Stands Still. Engo's introduction. Once the delusive way of thinking is cut off, a thousand eyes are suddenly opened. One word blocking the stream of thought and all Nen actions are controlled. If there is anyone who would undergo the experience of dying the same death and living the same, is there anyone who would undergo the experience of dying the same death and living the same life as the Buddha? Truth is manifest everywhere. If you do not see it, here is an ancient example. See the following. Main subject. Jo-Joza asked Rinzai, what is the essence of Buddhism? Rinzai, getting up from his seat, seized him, slapped him, and pushed him away. Jo-Joza stood still. A monk standing by said, Jo-Joza, why don't you bow? When Jo-Joza bowed, he suddenly became enlightened. Secho's verse, inheriting the spirit of Donsei, how could he be gentle and quiet? Not difficult for Kyore to lift his hands and split Mount Kasan, letting the Yellow River run through. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. This collective energy is really quite wonderful. Everybody's sitting so still together. This morning we have had visitors. This place is usually totally deserted. And this morning we had visitors who must be in some way involved with the homecoming ceremony. And so when we were doing our kinhin in one room, our minds very focused on each step, very focused on our breath, people in the hallway right next to us were chattering and running about and having a good time. And the discontinuity is something you might or might not have noticed. But it definitely reminded me of a sesshin we had long, long ago. You know, after Genki Roshi came to the United States from Daitokuji, our group began to grow rather fast. And the place we had done sesshin at was really not able to accommodate so many people. So we went through a long period of wandering around at different sesshin locations. And Webb Roshi, Webb Sensei at that time, would spend a lot of time looking for appropriate places to hold sesshin. And we had some really wonderful sesshin. We had a sesshin out in a place called Moses Lake. And Moses Lake is out in the desert of Washington State. And we were able to rent the main hall and a number of the bunkhouses for our sesshin. And it was like 110 degrees out there when we had our sesshin. The cook had to scrap all the recipes because they were all for hot food, and he had to make cool soups and cold food. It was just so hot. And we would go to bed at night. I remember one night we were going to bed from a day of zazen, and there was a full moon in the sky, and the coyotes were howling. You know, so we definitely had some really great sesshins during our vagabond period, you know. But then those were the pluses, you know. We had some really great sesshins. We had some sesshins that were in places that really weren't appropriate. So one time, Webb rented we rented space in a Catholic center. And we were in part of the building, and other parts of the building were being used for other functions. A little bit like the place we used to sit in Princeton, the Vincentian Renewal Center. And I remember we were on like about the third or fourth day of Sesshin, and we were doing Kinhin, and we turned down one of the hallways that we had been turning down in past days. And we ran smack dab into a senior prom. So we were doing our Kinhin. We were sort of walking through this crowd of drunken teenagers in chiffon dresses and blue tuxedos. And the interesting thing was that Webb, who was very, very careful to preserve the proper teaching environment for us, was really anxious that this had ruined our sesshin. But, you know, for me, it wasn't a problem at all. By around day four of sesshin, you know, I was fine with it, really. You know, I just did my Kinhin through the crowd of teenagers. But it is something I remember because it was so weird. When the Buddha was still living at home with his parents, he realized that he couldn't wake up at home. His father was probably a tribal chieftain. In Buddhist mythology, his father said to be a king. But actually, in that part of India, they didn't have kings. They had a confederation of, you could say, city-states, like Greece. And there were different areas, you could say, like clans, like the Scottish clans, like the MacDonalds the MacDougalls. You know, there were different clans that lived in different areas. So the Buddha's father was really like a tribal chieftain or like a clan chieftain, a little bit like the, you know, Celtic people. The Celtic people. So anyway, he was living at home, and he realized, you know, there's no way I'm going to wake up here. And when he talked about it later, he said, you know, the life of the householder is a dusty life. You know, my wife and I had an event recently. She had a bunch of friends coming over, and we had to really clean up the house. And I was amazed at how, I was thinking about what the Buddha said as I was dusting, you know. Because there's a lot of dust, you know. But he didn't mean just there's a lot of dust. He meant there's a lot of distractions, right? I mean, there's a lot of distractions. By the way, the Buddha, 27 of the Buddha's students were lay people, that is, not monks and nuns. And they achieved full enlightenment. So the Buddha wasn't critical of the householder's life when it came to waking up. But in his early life, he said, you know, I can't wake up in this house. You know, basically what we would say is the TV is on all the time. People are coming and going. You know, everybody's talking. I've got to get out of this house. So the Buddha went out into the woods, and he meditated basically in the woods. The Buddha joined a movement of people called the Sramanas, the Sramanas. In the Buddha's time, there was a movement mostly of young people. And they were rebelling against the way of life that was established at that time. They wanted a different way of life. They wanted to know who we are, where we come from, and where we're going. and they didn't believe what their parents told them, and they didn't believe what was written in their sacred scriptures. So, you know, they went out into the woods and they meditated in small groups or by themselves. And the Buddha himself was one of these shramanas, and he often chose very remote places to do his meditation. So it was said in later Buddhism that the Buddha used to go to places like graveyards. You know, there's a graveyard near my house, and it's actually a beautiful place. And it, you know, if you were going to meditate, it's the perfect place to meditate. You know, hardly anybody lives there. And so the Buddha used to go to forest glens where he could be alone, like up in the Stokes State Forest, or he would go to graveyards. And, it, you know, there's something to this, right? I mean, you have to sort of get out of your house, you get away from the TV, get away from the distractions, turn off your phone, you know. That's the dust, the red dust of this world, right? And find a quiet place to meditate. You know, and sometimes if you meditate at home, and I hope you do, that means maybe getting up early before everybody else is up, which is very hard. Or, you know, maybe you can find a time when before your kids come home or after your kids are asleep or something, sometime during the day when you can meditate on your own. Very hard to find. You know, which makes a place like this so important, right? When I was living in Seattle, I was living in an apartment complex, and I've mentioned this before, but there were some graduate students from Iran, some Persians, in the apartment, I guess it was under me. And when I would get up in the morning to meditate, you know, they had their TV on at like, it seemed like 5:30 in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning. I couldn't believe it. I think they just turned it on as soon as they woke up, or maybe they never turned it off. But I could hear the, you know, I could hear the Today Show through the wall. So it was a powerful incentive for me to come and go, to sit at the Seattle Zen Center. And even though it was difficult, it was definitely worth it to be able to go to a place where I could have real quiet, real quiet. You know, especially when you are just getting started, you know, it's really important to turn everything off, get away from the distractions, find a quiet place, and focus on your breath. And, you know, our lives today are even more dusty than they were in the Buddhist time. Because, you know, a house in the Buddhist time would have been, it would have had, you know, kids either playing or crying or playing and crying. You would have had, you know, people, you know, working, doing hammering, sawing, you know, making fires, whatever you had to do, you know, basically threshing grain, you know, you name it. All these are like very noisy activities. And now we have like the we have the internet. We have, you know, my wife has a phone. I don't actually have a phone anymore. And every once in a while she will. I'll be sitting with her, and we might be reading, and all of a sudden her phone makes all these different noises. It buzzes, it dings, it rings, and it's so annoying, right? You know, I don't have a phone because I don't want to be available in all those ways. You know, if people want to contact me, they can call me on the regular phone, and I have an answering machine, and they could send me an email. But I don't want that to be it. Constantly subject to messaging, right? I don't know. Apparently, Barbara enjoys it, but I don't enjoy it. You know, so there's all this distraction. So it's so important to come to a place like this, and it's quiet, and it's peaceful, and you begin to watch your breath, and you really begin, at first it's a big struggle to get through your thoughts, because your thoughts are sort of like highly conditioned by the life you lead, And you see this when you sit down on the cushion. So if you're the kind of person who watches TV and balances her checkbook, and, at the same time you're having a conversation on your speakerphone with somebody or something like that, when you sit down on the cushion, you realize just how pulled in many different directions your mind really is. I remember when I lived in Seattle. Seattle's a big movie town. And on Saturday night or a Sunday night, a lot of my friends would go out and see a movie. We would see these European films that were so engaging and art house movies, And when I would go to sit on Monday morning at the Zen Center, I realized one day I could almost replay the whole movie in my head, The movie was right under the surface of my consciousness. And if you've had an argument with somebody at work, you sit down on the cushion, there's the argument. Our conscious mental activity is almost like a mirror image, or it retains the mirror images of what's happened during the day. So if you're very stressed at work, you sit down on the cushion, it's very hard to escape from that mood of pressure or stress. If you're writing all day, if you're in some kind of line of work where you have to write all day, you sit down on the cushion, you often find yourself composing on the cushion. It's hard not to repeat those mental habits when you sit down on the cushion and try to watch your breath. So one way to think about meditation practice early on is that it's like deconditioning the mind or cleaning up the mind. You're bringing the mind back to the present moment, back to the present moment, back to the present moment, and you have all of these mental habits and all of this mental baggage that's distracting you, right? Everybody who's done meditation for a while remembers what this is like. You're focused on the breath, and then this thought comes up, and you're focused on the breath, and you think, "Oh my God, I've got to get that report done." And then you focused on the breath, and then you think about something you did 10 years ago. Very hard to be present with your breath. But when you're in that condition, you can see very clearly what your ordinary everyday mind is like. People are highly distracted, and that highly distracted state is just a product of or reflection of our lifestyle. We lead a lifestyle that has, it's an information society. And all of these different sources of information are competing for our attention and trying actually to addict us. There's no question about this. The people who invented Facebook meant it to be addictive. And other web technologies are also meant to be sticky. They say sticky, they don't say addictive, because they don't want to feel like pushers. But they are pushers. They want them to be sticky. If you're a Facebook user, and I'd put stuff on Facebook. First you post something on Facebook, then you go to see who of your friends have looked at it. And if you do this a couple times a day, you begin to crave knowing, right? Who just connected. You've got to know. So pretty soon you're going to, if you're not careful, you're going to Facebook many times a day. And of course, the more web traffic Facebook gets, the more their stock goes up. And so they love it when you're tied into the system. In ancient times, people didn't live this way. You could say ancient people were information poor, but that's not quite right. You know, but people definitely didn't have all of these distractions. In the Buddhist time, by comparison to now, people was not so dusty. You know, you would go out and maybe you had to plant rice for the day. And, you know, pretty much all you would do all day is plant rice, you know. I mean, I myself have spent when I was young, I did a lot of physical labor. I was a day laborer in the summer for my summer job. And later I worked as a carpenter. And, you know, actually, when you do those kinds of tasks, it really does simplify your mind. You know, if you're just carrying shingles up to a roof all day, first of all, it's very tough physically. You have to watch where you put your feet or you'll fall and die, right? So you have to concentrate. You have to be in the moment. But after a while, you know, you're just in the moment. It's actually a very positive experience, you know, just to, you know, be tired at the end of the day and you look at your mind and you have an empty mind. So you know, our ancestors probably had healthier minds in some ways than we do today. It's very difficult to get to a place where the mind is really quiet and still, you know. But when you get to that place, it's so refreshing, right? I can remember, you know, when I was in Seattle, I had just started studying with Genki Roshi, and I had so many stresses, or at least I thought I had so many stresses. Now I would find it easy to deal with, but at the time it just seemed overwhelming. You know, I had my classes, I had reading for my classes, I had papers to write, I was teaching, so I had papers to grade, and I had other things going on too, and I just felt so stressed. You know, I would go to one of my graduate classes and my professor would ask me a question and I didn't give a very good answer, or I gave an answer that was, you know, positively terrible, right? That happened. You know, I would go home and I would just feel like I'm not succeeding at this game. Maybe I don't belong in graduate school, but then what'll I do? You know, I can't move furniture for the rest of my life for the Mayflower Moving Company. So, you know, I was under a lot of stress, and I would come into the Zen Center, and, you know, usually when I would, especially in the morning, you know, I would get to the cushion in the morning, and the first thing I would think is, oh my God, what am I doing here? I've got so much to do, I shouldn't be here. But then, you know, because the Zen Center was pretty far from my house, and I got a ride with a friend, I couldn't really escape. So then I just started watching my breath, and I would forget all about my worries, and an hour into the sit, I felt like I was in heaven. You know, to be released from all those cares and just be present with the breath. And the Zen Center was up on a hill, away from traffic. It was a very quiet place. And it was so serene, right? It was just so serene. You know, and then at 7 o'clock, we'd start at 5:30, and at 7 o'clock, we'd have a Japanese-style breakfast. We'd have rice, miso soup, some stir-fried vegetables, and skimono, some pickles. And then we'd go off to our day. You know, it was just so wonderful. So, you know, there was definitely a very sharp contrast between my life, my dusty, distracted, everyday life, and my Zen life, you know? I began to really look forward to getting to that quiet and peace of the cushion. You know, that stillness is so beautiful, right? And it was so refreshing. I felt like I was a wounded animal, you know, really. I felt like when I would get to the cushion, I would feel like torn apart by life. And, you know, you sit in that, you watch the breath, your mind is focused just on the breath, your thoughts recede, you enter samadhi, that deep state of a meditative, it's sometimes a meditative absorption. What's really happening is the boundary between yourself and the world is dropping away. And now you feel connected to the world. And because you're in a safe space, you're in the Zendo, you know, it's quiet, You're not going to be assaulted. Nobody's going to assault you. You know, your boundaries, your guard is down, and you connect with the world. And it's like, you know, when that first happens to you, it's so beautiful, so blissful. It's like going home. It's like, wow, you know, where have you been all my life, you know? Samadhi is so great, you know? I mean, it's definitely true that in our romantic relationships, we sometimes have that same experience. You meet somebody and you think, wow, I feel my guard is down when I'm around you. I can be myself. See, it's so beautiful, so rare. But in samadhi, that's the same thing. You know, your guard is down, and the world is not going to hurt you. And the two of you fuse together, and it's this beautiful, beautiful, like, it's like home. I'm home, see. You know, and this is like nourishing. To keep going back to this place, you know, life can be so wounding and tough, you know, and stressful. And if you make a habit of coming to sit and sitting on the cushion and you train yourself, sooner or later you'll really get into samadhi, maybe not every time at the same depth, but you'll get there almost all the time. I mean, after a while you'll get there every time. And to me, it feels like plugging myself into an electric socket. You know, it's just like, oh, this warm energy flowing through my body. It's so beautiful. You know, so please don't live without samadhi. You know, please don't live without this restorative energy, this beautiful, beautiful stillness. You know. But, see, there's a problem with this too. You know, in this koan, there's an old monk whose name is Jojoza. And Jojoza has been sitting at the temple for more than 20 years. And he's never had a great awakening experience. And so, you know, he's frustrated. He doesn't know how to go forward in his practice. And so he comes up to Rinzai and he says, you know, I've been doing this for 20, 25 years. You're the great Linji. You're the great Linji. You know, tell me, what am I doing wrong? You know, why haven't I wakened up? And he says, what is the essence of Buddhism? And then the koan says, Rinzai, Linji, getting up from his seat, seized him, slapped him, and pushed him away. Now, you know, please don't do that to anybody. But what's that all about, see? Well, you know, I urge you to put meditation at the center of your life. You will never regret it. You will never regret it. And your life will be so, your life will be so vivid and joyful. But, you know, you can also, and this is really for people who have been practicing for a while, you can also limit yourself to the cushion. Limit yourself to the cushion. See, you know, Linji was famous for criticizing his fellow monks. He used to come into the Zendo sometime. He was the teacher. He got to say what he wanted to say. And he would say, you shaven-headed monks, you eat your black beans and your rice and you sit on your ass all day and you don't know anything about enlightenment. See? And some people who don't really understand Chan, who don't understand Zen, misunderstand what Linji was saying, Rinzai was saying. You know, Rinzai did a lot of meditation all his life. But Alan Watts, whose books are wonderful, I highly recommend The Way of Zen if you want an introductory book to Zen. But he read Linji saying that, and he said, Linji said, don't sit, don't meditate. And Alan Watts was wrong, let me just say. You need to meditate a lot so that you can enter deep samadhi and so that you can enter deep samadhi quite regularly. When you sit, if you practice regularly, at first, you know, you come in, you do three sits or two sits, and you don't hit samadhi at all. You know, eventually you have three sits, and in one of them, maybe towards the end, you enter samadhi. Eventually, you know, more of the sits are in samadhi. And eventually, you know, you can get into samadhi with great regularity. You know, my Genki Roshi used to say he would sit down on the cushion and be in deep samadhi, and it was absolutely true. I know exactly what he's saying. So the problem is, if you stop with the cushion, you can't fully develop. See, that's what Linji meant. What Rinzai meant was, you have to be able to take it off the cushion, or you can become a prisoner of your own practice. See, I mean, if I can come in and sit down on the cushion and enter deep samadhi, excellent. But what happens if there's a bunch of noisy kids next door squeaking and squealing, see? Or worse, you know, when we used to have sesshin at my house, we actually had a sesshin once. You know, where I live is very quiet. Our street is so quiet. And we used to have sesshin at my house. And I had planned it all out perfectly. And wouldn't you know, the city of Plainfield decided to cut down a big tree in front of my house the week of sesshin. So, you know, I called them up and they said, "We're sorry, but, you know, it's scheduled for that day. We've got to take it down." So, you know, we were meditating in my house, and outside they're cutting a tree up with power saws, right? And, you know, it's possible to say, you know, "You're ruining my samadhi. You're ruining my samadhi." See, I hope I'm making some sense, but, you know, you need to be able to enter very deep samadhi, but at some stage in your practice, you have to take your samadhi off the cushion. Off the cushion. See. You know, I'll never forget talking to Webb, because Webb had gone through very rigorous training at Myoshinji. He hadn't had Daikensho, but he came back to the United States and later had Daikensho at a sesshin that Genki Roshi was conducting. But Webb was quite typical, you know, he could enter deep samadhi on the cushion, but he actually told me once, you know, he said, you know, it was such a shock. He finished the sit on a Wednesday night. He got on the bus to go back to, he lived across Lake Washington. And he said he suddenly realized that he was on the bus and he was in the deepest samadhi on the bus. You know, legs weren't crossed, but he was in deep, deep samadhi on the bus. You know, people in front of him are chattering away. And see, this is a very important moment in your practice. You know, you definitely need to go to a quiet place. You definitely need to be able to have fewer thoughts. You definitely need to get away from the dust, right? But at some point, you know, if you stay in that, if you cling, you know, you'll hear people say meditation is about silence and stillness. And, you know, that's true to a point. That's sort of like an intermediate or advanced beginner's perspective. See, you know, that's sort of an advanced beginner or intermediate practitioner's perspective. That's somebody who still clings to stillness and quiet. If Buddhism were just about stillness and quiet, see, there wouldn't be much to Buddhism. See, you know, when you're on your cushion and you're in your beautiful samadhi and somebody knocks at the door and you have to get up and you go, "God damn it, you've interrupted my beautiful samadhi." See, your world has been cut right in two. So now your practice is about defending your beautiful samadhi from all the challenges from outside. See? And that is exactly samsara. your world has been cut into, and now you feel very cut off from everything around you. Remember I said, you know, the first experiences of samadhi are the boundary between yourself drops away because you feel trust in the world. You know you're not going to be hurt, so you put the boundaries down and you merge with the world. But you have to do that now off the cushion in your life. See, that's a challenge because, of course, you know, sometimes there's somebody outside with a jackhammer or with a, you know, a saw cutting up logs, you know, and it sounds rude and it's difficult to deal with, right? But you can't fully develop if you don't begin that process after a certain point in your training. You have to get off the cushion and take your samadhi power out into the world, see? And, you know, you can find it's absolutely true that right in the middle of chaos, you can be in deep samadhi. You can be in deep... I mean, I discovered that when I got here to Rutgers. You know, when I came to Rutgers, my office is now very orderly. But when I first had my job, first of all, everybody in the office was a chain smoker. So I probably lost a few years, I don't know. But they all smoked, and the place was a madhouse. There was no organization. You know, it would be like one crisis after another. It would be, and I remember, you know, we were having some crisis, and I'm sitting there, and at that time, my secretary's name was Elaine Jones. And she said, you know, how come you're always so calm? And I hadn't really thought of it, because I wasn't trying to be calm. But, you know, you can get into samadhi all the time. And you can be in the middle of, like, chaos, and you're just as serene as you can be. And that's an essential step in your practice. There's no substitute for those earlier steps. But at some point, you have to take your... And by the way... It works the other way. You know, there was a guy in our group for a while. He's no longer in our group. But he used to come into Dokusan, and I have, you can be sure I'll never say, you know, I'll never reveal anything about Dokusan that you tell me. What I'm about to tell you is nothing intimate or private, and I'm not identifying the person. He would come into the Dokusan room, and he would say, I'd say, how's it going? And he'd say, that Dokusan room, he said, it's a madhouse. Pardon me. He would come into the Dokusan room, and I'd say, how's it going? And he'd say, that Zendo is a madhouse. I'd say, the Zendo is a madhouse? And he said, oh my God, people are moving, they're breathing hard. You know, he made it sound like people were hitting each other with chairs in there. So, you know, one time, after he would come in and report that the Zendo was very unruly, people were, you know, shifting around, and there was no discipline. And one time I just peeked. You know, before Dokusan started, I left for Dokusan, and then I went back and I peeked through the door. It was like you could hear the crickets chirping. Right, his mind was agitated. See. So he was sitting in a room where maybe somebody shifted his posture a little bit, or maybe somebody burped, or somebody coughed. And for him, those were like earthquakes, see? So you know, his mind was not grounded in samadhi. You know, if your mind is really grounded in samadhi, you can have a hurricane outside and you're calm. You know, so it's essential at some point in your practice to take the practice off the cushion and be, you know, if you go for walks, you know what samadhi feels like. Watch your breath as you're going for a walk and try to stay in samadhi for your walk. Seriously. You know, you'll notice that you can stay for, you know, it might surprise you. You can be in... deep, sustained concentration, very calm, grounded mind as you're walking around. You know, don't try it in New York, because you might get hit by a bus, but it's definitely possible in a park or if you live in a rather uncrowded place. it's very important to try to do this, especially in stressful situations, right? So, you know, we tend to think of koan training as being something that we do on the cushion. But, you know, most people realize how to respond to their koans off the cushion. You know, it's often the case that people will come in to see me for Dokusan, and I'll say, well, what have you got? You know, you're working on the koan, and they'll give me an answer that's a really good answer or a very good response, and I'll say, you know, when did that come to you? And they say, well, I was in the kitchen, I was chopping carrots. You know, that's often the case. You know, in other words, you know, they're not just doing their koan on the cushion. They're chopping carrots, and at some place in their mind, they're processing that koan. You know, if your koan is Joshu's stone bridge, you know, while you're chopping carrots, you know, look for the stone bridge. You know, the koan is not confined to the cushion. You know, take it off the cushion. You know, one of the good things about calling mu is that, you know, you can do it on the cushion, but you really have to, you should just go outside in the woods and call mu. So it sort of forces you to get off the cushion. See, calling mu is so good because it actually forces you not to stay passive, not to stay in that stillness, but to enter this active mode. It's like active samadhi. Active samadhi. So, you know, eventually you realize that it's possible to be in samadhi all the time. You know, samadhi isn't, being in samadhi is not is not dependent on causes and conditions. See, it requires stillness, quiet, undusty situation, right? You definitely have to get away from the TV, get away from whatever, you know, and turn off the electric devices and sit down and find a precious quiet place like this room where you can practice. We turn down the lights. Yes, all essential. But eventually you'll notice you can be in deep samadhi while you're making dinner. You know, you can be in deep samadhi at a meeting at work. You know, I've been in many stressful meetings, and I just start watching my breath, or I call moo, and it's like I'm cool as a cucumber. You know, it has helped me so much, and I can remember moments. I was in graduate school, and I was going to a very stressful meeting with this senior professor who was incredibly arrogant and unpleasant. I just was sitting there waiting for him to show up, and I just realized, you know, I feel so calm, I'm so grounded. And he came in, and I didn't care. Who cares, you know? If he doesn't want to work with me, fine. Who cares, you know? And it wasn't, I really was there, you know? It's like, take me or leave me, you know? I'm fine, I'll live, you know, I'll be fine. It wasn't about circumstances anymore. You know, I could be there all the time. You know, and in advanced, for people who have been doing this for a long time, you know, there are still things that knock you out of your samadhi. You know, there are still things that will knock you off balance, knock you out of your samadhi, and you realize, wait a minute, hey, I'm not in samadhi right now, I'm really anxious. Or, you know, about 10 years ago, I was on the way to the, Barbara and I were on the way to the gym, and some guy hit us from the side. We had just driven away from our house, and we were going to the gym, and some guy crashed right into the side of the car. And I reached for my, I knew, you know, there was an accident, both of the cars were incapacitated, and I reached for my wallet, and I didn't have my wallet. And I thought, oh my God. So I was like 2 blocks from my house. I actually ran all the way to my house and got my wallet and came back and sat back in the car. So I didn't get a ticket for driving without a license. But, and I was anxious, so I wasn't in samadhi. So next time I have an accident, I'll work on being in samadhi. But that's like, that's a practice, right? You know, being in samadhi off the cushion, or working with your koan off the cushion. You know, the koan is not confined to that space, right? You take it into your life. And it's also the case that you're practicing all the time, whether you realize it or not. You know, somebody actually said to me the other day, you know, I think I'm actually working on my koan all the time. It's like, yes, you are. You know, your conscious mind is busy with whatever, but your unconscious mind is processing your koan. So, you know, Jojo Za is a very nice man who has given his life to the Dharma. So, totally admirable person. And he has practiced wholeheartedly. But he has gotten stuck in a cushion-centric practice, right? And that's a problem. And that's what Lin Ji was all about. Lin Ji kept saying, you know, this is not just a ritual on the cushion that we do. We have to get off the cushion and take our samadhi power out into the world. And by the way, you know, you develop mental focus. You develop a kind of samadhi power. You know, so, you know, it wasn't very noisy this morning. There was a little noise occasionally. And when that happens, you just focus more intensely on your breath or on mu or on your koan, and you sink more deeply into samadhi. It's the same thing with physical discomfort at sesshin. You know, your leg hurts at sesshin, and you could move every 2 minutes, but that's not going to help. Or you could leave sesshin, and that's not going to help either. So you realize, I'm just going to sit with this discomfort and go into deep samadhi. And you follow the breath out, and when you follow the breath out, you sink deep, deep into samadhi, and your pain recedes, right? And then it comes back, and you do it again, and the pain recedes. And all this time, you're dropping into deep, deep, deep samadhi. You see? And this is like doing push-ups with, you know, push-ups. You know, if you do, right now, I could probably only do one push-up. But I do other exercises, and at first I couldn't do very many of those, but I've gotten really good at those. You know, you strengthen your chest muscles and your arms, and eventually you can do 50 push-ups. Well, your concentration is like that too. There's nothing mystical about it. You know, everything in Buddhism is a matter of applying yourself, making the effort. There's nothing magical or mystical about it. You know, so, you know, you can build your samadhi power up by doing a lot of sitting, and sometimes you have physical discomfort, and that's a golden opportunity to build up your samadhi power. You know, in one of the koans it says about a deeply awakened person, you can hit him with a two, it doesn't say 2x4, but it's basically, you can hit him with a 2x4 and he won't even look up at you. In other words, he's in such deep samadhi. See, so Jojo Za's problem is not that he can't get into deep samadhi, but that he hasn't taken it off the cushion. So his world is cut in two. There's the beautiful whole world on the cushion, and outside he's defending himself all the time. And so his world is divided. So when you begin to be able to enter into samadhi off the cushion, in the middle of stressful situations, your world is becoming more and more unified. This is what Seng Tsan means when he says a unified mind in accord with the way. All self-centered striving ceases, doubts and irresolutions vanish, and life in true trust is possible. See, that's what he means. Engo's introduction. Once the delusive way of thinking is cut off, 1,000 eyes are suddenly opened. One word blocking the stream of thought, and all Nen actions are controlled. So Nen is like mental moments. So when we sit down on the cushion and we watch our breath or focus on a koan, our Nen action is becoming rhythmical, focused, and so on. Okay. Is there anyone who would undergo the experience of dying the same death and living the same life as the Buddha? Do you want to wake up? Well, then, truth is manifest everywhere, not just on the cushion, although you have to sit. If you do not see it, here is an ancient example. Main subject, Jojoza asked Rinzai, what is the essence of Buddhism? Rinzai, see, he knows exactly what Joe's problem is. He gets up from his seat, sees him, and slapped him and pushed him away. Jojoza stood still. A monk said, Jojoza, why don't you bow? So when he bows, he goes into deep samadhi. and his mind is transformed. When Jojoza bowed, he suddenly became enlightened. Secho's verse, inheriting the spirit of Dansei, how could he be gentle and quiet? See, Zen is not about being gentle and quiet. It's about the unified mind in accord with the way. When you feel yourself pulling away, when you feel aversion arising, that noise that's annoying you, the more you try to block it out, the more your world is cut in two. Become one with. Inheriting the spirit of Dansei, how could he be gentle and quiet? Not difficult for Kyore to lift his hands and split Mount Kasan, letting the yellow river through. So, unified mind in accord with the way, it's like you're at harmony with whatever happens. You become one with events, see? That's full realization.